Hello, and welcome back to the 305. This is episode number 8, where I'm going to be watching The Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956. My guest today is Sean McGill.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
He is a local to Chicago musician, also an actor, and a film buff, especially in horror and sci-fi. And he is currently playing with the Chicago bands Turn and Fire and You Beautiful Creature.
Yay! Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
This is my podcast debut. I could not be more thrilled to be here.
How have you... Podcasts are like what everybody turned to in the pandemic. How have you not already created your own podcast, frankly?
I got really into gardening and smoking meats this summer. And
okay.
I'm just now starting to get locked away, so we'll see. Maybe there's a podcast on the horizon.
Well, you'll build up your experience here.
Well, this might be just kind of a bucket list thing. Like,
yeah,
I think I've always wanted to do a podcast and have it go well. So if this goes really well, I may just never have to do this again. So,
I can say that I discovered you.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. So, what is your current experience with this movie? Have you ever seen this before?
If I've seen this movie, I saw this movie one time, maybe years and years ago, like in college. I think I saw it during a film studies class during the summer that was like a sci-fi horror class. And, I definitely have seen the remake that had Donald Sutherland in it, but I don't know if I've actually seen this movie. So I might discover about 15 minutes in, I was like, oh, I think I do remember this, but. We'll see. I'm excited.
Good. Have you seen either of the other two remakes? I saw there was Body Snatchers from 93 and The Invasion from 2007 with Nicole Kidman.
I have not seen either one of those.
Okay. Well, me neither. So we're going into this mostly cold.
Yes. Yeah, like kind of like a chill, like kind of cool.
Yeah. What are you, I guess, do you have any expectations of this movie based on what you know?
I mean, this movie, it was I remember, I don't know if it was ever like a big hit, but I know that it obviously must have done well enough that they warranted a remake, because there weren't too many, a lot of remakes happening. This came, the remake to the first one came out in
78, I think.
78?
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, really, aside from, like, Carpenter's The Thing is about the only other one that really jumps out at me a bit was, like, taken from, like, a 50s movie. The plot wouldn't come until the 80s. So I don't really have too much with it. I just judging from what I know of, like, the 70s remake, I imagine this has probably got some Cold War paranoia. I mean, like, the idea of an outer force that takes you over and suddenly you become this autonomous, like, drone.
What could that possibly mean?
That's stuff that was all, like, real common among, like, the sci-fi movies and stuff and the nuclear scares and stuff, so.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of me spitballing before I watch it. That's about what I know.
All right. Well, speaking of which, we should watch this movie. Yeah, we will take our usual break here and see you after the jump.
You on the other side.
It was thought by everybody in Hollywood while I was in South America that it was too downbeat, famous Hollywood word at the time, downbeat. So it was all taken out. But it was the purpose of the movie. Was to see how they all slid downhill, you see, in one way or another.
Next episode, we'll be watching a film famously altered by the studio against director Orson Welles' wishes, going so far as to destroy the deleted material, thus creating a semi-lost classic, 1942's The Magnificent Ambersons. Okay, here we are, fresh off of watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers. We've already had a take at our discussion here. And of course, the wrong audio input was selected. So here we are with take two.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel good about this.
But so that was it was a really good movie. Really solid sci-fi thriller, really. More than a horror, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. A lot of like film noir elements, especially like in the lighting, in the kind of overly melodramatic dialogue.
Yeah.
Some of the acting is very big in this movie, like but I love the camera angles in this movie and the way just a lot of the maneuvers that they did. And they only shot this, I think, in like 20 days, 24 days, something like that.
Yeah, a couple. It was like 3 weeks and they went, I think it said 3 or 4 days over schedule just because they wanted to shoot real nighttime shots rather than faking it during the daytime.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think really helped. Like it's. I always find it super noticeable when an old movie tries to do day for night because it like, oh, it's nighttime, which just means everything is really blue.
Yeah.
But this was like, you know, it was dark and there was that shot, that great shot of him, the main guy, Miles, he's with Becky. They're just out of the car. They've opened the trunk and found two of the pods.
Yeah.
And they throw him on the ground and light him on fire in front of the camera. That was so cool.
And then the car drives off just in the distance as the flames burn out. That's also love them hiding in the tunnel, like in the cave there with the boards.
Oh
the
yeah.
The way they pulled that down and just in the background you can just watch the people run through.
All the people going overhead. Yeah, it was an unusual shot.
Yeah, there was some really, really good stuff. And there was the other one, the closet one, where they had the grating over the closet. They were hiding them in the closet.
Uh-huh, and then they just barely... Yeah, it was beautiful. Yeah. They had the two main characters, Becky and Miles, they're hiding just under the window of a door to avoid detection. And the light comes on outside, and it just barely illuminates their faces around the door as somebody peeks through the door. It was very well set up.
Good stuff.
Well, what did you think of the storyline?
I think we touched on this in the first take, but like this movie, like, I mean, it drips of kind of Red Scare paranoia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This sort of idea that people will come amongst you. They'll look exactly like you. They'll talk exactly like you. They'll have all the same memories, but there'll just be this one thing that's just different. And it's the fact that they're not really free. They don't really feel like emotion. They don't feel joy or happiness or sorrow or anything. They just live in a society where everyone is the same.
Yeah.
And that seems to be like, that's what, I mean, it's even in the trailer, the way that it was marketed, like, the guy is like, well, I don't want any part of that.
That's a good impression.
Oh, thank you. I was working on my Kevin McCarthy throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, surely, the noted actor.
But, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of the impression I got. We were talking a little bit about it, and the sort of the anti-McCarthy sort of feel of it, and that it's sort of interesting that the star and the director and all that stuff were all like very much like, oh, you know, people started assigning all these meanings to movies at this time and stuff. And we just really wanted to make a thriller. I kind of have to chuckle because you're right. They probably did have to say that.
Yeah. There was a good quote. I think it was on Wikipedia that you're looking at the director, he said, I think that the world is populated by pods, and I wanted to show them. I think so many people have no feeling about cultural things, no feeling of pain, of sorrow. The political reference to Senator McCarthy and totalitarianism was inescapable, but I tried not to emphasize it because I feel that motion pictures are primarily to entertain, and I didn't want to preach.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah. I was pointing out earlier that there was a similar thing with the last movie, High Noon, where even though it was written with this sort of obvious anti-communist vibe, a lot of people also took it the opposite way of anti-McCarthyism. And you can see how it's interesting how like both sides of that argument are essentially about not following the crowd.
Yeah.
Which seems to be just like you were saying about American cinema in general, like there's so much about just the idea of independence and freedom to think for yourself.
That idea of American individualism and stuff, that's always been kind of very like fervent in a lot of Hollywood's mainstream put out, like,
definitely,
you know.
And even some of the non-mainstream stuff, like I brought up They Live,
yeah,
from John Carpenter, which to me had a very similar a similar premise of like there's all of these secret aliens everywhere, you have no idea who they are unless of course you put on the cool sunglasses.
Yep.
But once you do, you realize like, oh, like everybody is the same, they're all out to get you. The media is trying to control you. I guess it's all about control, really. Like, people are worried the communists want to control you. They're worried McCarthy wants to control you.
Yeah, and in Carpenter's, like, I mean, it was also, like, really heavy on the fact that it was all about consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
You were basically hypnotized into this lifestyle that you consume these things, you read these things, you believe these things, you go to bed, you wake up, you die. You know, like, it's that you're just a drone that lives this sort of meaningless life of distraction. You're basically just a drone, or as long as you just do exactly what you're told and, you know, stay in your place, you'll be fine.
Do you have any thoughts into why that's so popular in American cinema and just the culture at large?
I
know that's a big question.
I mean, the idea of American in general is the idea that you live, you're entitled to live a life of freedom, of happiness. That there's such a thing as justice in the world. And I think that those are values that we as Americans, hopefully at least, hold sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're trying to, I suppose when you're trying to like appeal to a mass market, you probably create heroes and stuff that identify with those same values, and your enemy's always sort of going to be the thing that threatens that. Like if it's not your freedom, it's your life, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's off sort of off the top of my head. I mean,
sure, but that's, I mean, there's so many movies with these big heroes taking on the world.
That's all over the place in all your old Westerns. And, I mean, even movies today, like superhero movies and stuff like that. I mean, most of the Marvels, I don't really know of any. Well, I guess Black Panther, of course, but there's not too many other ones that aren't like from America, you know, like Iron Man's from America. Spider-Man's based in America. Hulk, pretty much all of the Avengers except for Black Panther are like from America, and they're
even Captain America,
even especially Captain America. And I think like Captain America suspiciously should be just called Captain United States because But that's neither here nor there. The point is, granted, they're always, of course, they're trying to save the world and humanity as we know it and stuff. But like, it's very coincidental that they all happen to be mostly from the continental United States. I guess I've sort of lost my train of thought there. But like, all of our heroes really in American cinema, they're at least. They're always trying to hold dear our value of individual freedom, I guess. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think I'm rambling at this point.
No, I think it's still a valid point. I dig it. It actually, something I wrote down was that it reminded me also of in philosophy class in college, we talked about the nature of identity and how like slippery that could be.
Sure.
And there were a few different thought experiments to demonstrate that were pretty close, I would say, to this movie of like, okay, if I go to bed and in the middle of the night, someone comes in, kills me, and replaces me with an exact duplicate, like it's got all the same memories, the same physical features, talks like me, sounds like me, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Is it me or is it just a duplicate? And I think it makes it, what makes it interesting is that if I'm, you know, me, I'm not around anymore. That other duplicate effectively does become really me because nobody can tell the difference.
That's true.
And like to put this into a literal, sure. One of the best like framings of that I thought was cool was the teleporter in Star Trek.
Mm.
One of the ideas of how a teleporter like that could work is that this machine scans your entire body, top to bottom, like atom by atom.
Uh-huh.
And at the other end, using materials that are available there, it recreates you atom by atom in the exact same configuration.
Whoa.
And then at the source, it just blows those particles away. And so the question then is like, have you teleported? And a lot of people would say, for all intents and purposes, yes, you've teleported and you get to continue on living your life. To me, I find that idea terrifying. And I would say, no, absolutely not. I've died and this crazy clone is running around.
Yeah, no, that is excellent. An excellent question. I did not realize that was how the teleporter on Star Trek technically worked.
Well, it's like one possible way it could work, let's say. Oh. I don't think they ever specified in Star Trek that was how it worked.
Oh, wow.
Other than they did occasionally have the teleporter malfunction, where it was like, at the very least, Kirk had that duplicate once, where they had evil Kirk running around and, you know, sexually assaulting people and so on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great.
That was a dark episode.
Damn.
Yeah.
That was back during Patrick Stewart's more wild years.
But I thought it was cool to see that come up in this movie with that all these people freaking out because it's like, I can't put my finger on it, but something is wrong.
Yeah. You bring up it was interesting because that was sort of what they were all implying, is that like, you'll just go to sleep and you'll wake up and it'll be like nothing happened. And then, mm-hmm. I don't know, it really, it does sort of like kind of beg the question of like, well, then what is really the harm?
Right.
Like, if nothing really changed, and like, I don't know, it just seemed, and it also seemed kind of odd that I guess what we'll call them, the pod people, the aliens.
Right.
They never really sold their case on like, oh no, it's like the same thing, literally the same thing. It was like, well, I won't have love. Sure, you'll have love. Like, I don't know why they didn't like just try to fudge that a little bit, you know?
Sure, they were surprisingly honest aliens.
Yeah, they really were. They were really calming about the whole thing too. It's like, oh well, yeah. They're like, just come with us, it'll be fine. It's like,
yeah.
Dinner, like, oh, okay, great.
Well, right up until, you know, 100 of them start chasing them up the hill.
Yeah, they suddenly didn't seem so peaceful then. Like, come on, we just really want to show you a calm, relaxing time.
I did look up, by the way, you know, I was wondering while we were watching it of where that staircase was.
Yeah.
So that staircase and the caves are actually right next to each other, just underneath the Hollywood sign. In Los Angeles. Yeah. It's called the Westshire Pelham Stairs and the Bronson Canyon Caves. You can go visit it today, I would assume.
Oh, wow.
I mean, assuming it's not on fire.
Sure. Well,
yeah, they've had some problems.
Oh, man. Oh, man. I hope they're doing all right out there. I was going to say, I wonder if they have a photo op available in the little crawl space.
Yeah, I wonder... I mean, I didn't even know they were there. I wonder if the caves are still open in any way.
That's a good point.
Yeah. But it's like right, so it's just west of Griffith Observatory, which is like up on the hill. It's been in a bunch of movies. It's like in this really sort of posh, you know, it's the Hollywood Hills. So that's where all the fancy houses go.
Nice.
Yeah.
Far out.
Yeah. So beyond that, I wrote down some stuff about the history of the movie here. So this movie was released by a company called Allied Artists Productions.
Yeah.
And they until just before this movie had been known as Monogram Productions. They were 100% a B movie company. That was their bread and butter. It was all, they did Westerns, they did sci-fi. They had this really like ridiculous comedy series called The Bowery Boys. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of The Bowery Boys. I can't say that I'm like that I've ever actually seen it or listened to it.
I looked it up and it's like, it's clearly supposed to be teenagers, but they're played by 30-year-old men. Like they're barely making an effort beyond putting on some silly costumes.
You said, what was the name of that production company? You said it was Allied what?
Allied Artists Productions.
Allied Artists Productions.
Yeah, and eventually, so their two like most famous movies seem to be later on. They did Cabaret, the musical.
Oh, okay.
And Papillon with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman.
Oh.
Do you know that one about the guy who escapes from prison like a billion times?
I do not. I'm looking to see here.
It's a good movie.
Let's see, what have I seen here? Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, House on Haunted Hill. Alice, Sweet Alice. That was one of their last ones.
Another horror movie?
Yeah, it's kind of like a slasher. It wasn't quite like Halloween, like Mass Killer slasher. It was, almost positive, but I remember the opening credits had this really creepy doll, like as the this is the movie I'm thinking of. Yeah, they're the total B movies.
This movie, it was just a couple of years after they had this guy, I forget his name already, but this guy came in and was able to convince them, like, hey, we should actually try and make some big budget movies. Let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, they made a couple and they did okay. So yeah, they're like, okay, let's go back to the drawing board here. And so they ended up, they commissioned this movie. And originally it was going to have a budget of $450,000, which is like somewhere between $4.5 to $5 million.
Sure.
They ended up cutting it $100,000. Down to 350, because they just didn't have the money to produce this thing. So in today's
schedule too.
Fast schedule, not a lot of props needed. Mostly just shooting around Los Angeles. And actually my guess is that they shot it in black and white because it was cheaper.
Yeah.
Because in the 50s, I mean, there were still black and white movies, but I know color was becoming popular.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing was that this movie was based on a book called The Body Snatchers, I believe. And it was set in a real town called, what was it? Mill Valley? Something like that. It was this little town north of San Francisco. And they originally thought, well, let's do it all in location. Wouldn't that be cool? And so they went up there to scout everything out and discovered, no, it's impossible. It's way too much money to get everybody up here and get all these locations. So they're like, screw it. We'll just do it in Los Angeles. So they shot all over the place in Los Angeles, just wherever they could find, basically. Which I think like actually turned out really cool because it feels really natural. There's not a lot of places that feel like just studio sets.
Mm-hmm.
Like we talked about, they were able to do actual nighttime shots rather than faking it.
Yeah.
So I think they definitely, even though they were given a low budget to work with, they didn't really worry about it. They just said, okay, well, let's be creative within the constraints that we have.
Yeah.
That's the way
a lot of those like old film noir movies and stuff were shot in a matter of 2-3 weeks a lot of times and stuff.
Oh yeah.
you know, it always forced people to, when you're under crunch time like that, you don't have a lot of money. It forces you kind of to think outside of the box and use what you have available to you. And yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where you see a lot more. Rob Zombie was, not to digress too far on this. He has one of my favorite quotes when he was talking about his first movie, House of a Thousand Corpses. Mm-hmm. Like, Universal gave him a bunch of money because he was Rob Zombie and he made this movie. And then they kept wanting reshoots and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And because the cuts just weren't working all that well. And so Universal, like whoever was giving him money at the time, just kept throwing him money and stuff. And it eventually, like, it ended up, he made a movie and he wasn't ever quite as happy with it. And when they made Devil's Rejects, they, like, having saw what happened with the first movie, they didn't give him as much the second time around.
Sure.
Devil's Rejects is a far better movie. And he said in the commentaries, like, I learned, basically my lesson was you can throw, just because you throw money at it doesn't mean it makes it a better movie. Like,
absolutely.
Like, you know, having, you know, the constraints on him, like, forced him to think outside of the box. And he was like, frankly, is like a lot of the stuff that we came up with on the spot just ended up working for the location for what we had. And hey, you know, that's, I got to imagine that a lot of that stuff is probably similar with this. Like, that's the same with countless movies.
Yeah, definitely. And it definitely worked in this case, because they ended up making $3 million at the box office.
Nice.
On a budget of $400,000 it ended up being. So to relate that to today, that's like taking a $4 million movie and making $30 million on it. Which, like, in an era of blockbusters and big superhero movies, that doesn't sound like a lot, but yeah, when you make 7-8 times your budget, you've succeeded by any measure.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I think it was after, it was what, Halloween was one of the most successful, like, low budget independent movies for a long time, because it was only, it was made with, I think, a couple hundred thousand dollars, and by the time it finally national, like global gross was several million dollars. Wow. And the same Paranormal Activity movie that was made for that was made for like $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
Camcorder and raked in millions.
Yeah.
I think that technically the most successful, one of the most successful, like financially successful movies ever.
I believe it. Was Blair Witch the same way, or was that like fake low budget?
No, Blair Witch was same way. Blair Witch was, I want to say 35,000, but I think I might even be undercutting it there.
Mm-hmm.
What was the budget on it? Budget was $60,000, and wow, its grand box office was $248.6 million.
Jeez. Amazing what you can do.
Yeah. Horror stuff, man. It's always,
yeah. Yeah, definitely. I guess I was going to ask you, so something else I read in the history section about this movie was that it originally did not have the framing story around it of Miles showing up at this doctor's office in a panic and explaining the whole thing to them. And so it opened very calmly with that scene of them driving by Grimaldi's and the boy runs out.
Sure, sure, sure.
And then the ending, presumably, was just Miles out on the highway, like screaming like a nut job, trying to warn everybody, and of course not being listened to.
Oh, okay. So him screaming on the highway was originally where it stopped?
That would be my guess. I'm not 100% positive there.
Oh. I mean, the framing of it, I think that was added onto it. You're right. Like, that's completely accurate. Mm-hmm. I think they did that to, I think, sort of pad the ending. It doesn't, mm-hmm. I mean, it gives you, I mean, not to spoil it if you haven't watched it yet, but you probably shouldn't.
What are you listening to this podcast for then?
But them, like, kind of getting a hold on it, them, like, the doctors starting to believe him and stuff like that, it gives you the glimmer of hope that there might be, I guess, some sort of alliance, like, between the main character and some sort of authority that can maybe fight off the threat, or that the threat won't, you know, ultimately take hold. I personally am a much more, I'm a horror movie nut, so, like, I'm more a fan usually of the bleak endings.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, which one do you think would make a better movie?
I mean, ultimately, I think I would have preferred probably to see the alternate ending, but because that's also a little bit more in line with what happens in the remake with Donald Sutherland. Is it goes that extra minute of like, oh, you think everything's going to be, and then it's the end, it's hopeless, and it's terrible. It's great. And there is, of course, that famous picture of Donald Sutherland that you've seen.
Yeah. How did he even make that face? It's so weird.
You should hear the sound he makes.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. I think the darker ending is always the more appropriate when you have these allegory movies.
Right.
Just because if you're trying to drive a point home, I don't really see, I feel like you're sort of undercutting it if you give it much hope at the end.
I agree.
I mean, I know we spent, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours getting to know these people and stuff, but the movie's got to end, and maybe so do they.
Oh, okay. I just looked it up. I was right. It was meant to end with him screaming in the road.
Okay.
And what happened was the studio messed with it and said, no, 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 we can't have this like terrible pessimistic ending. Everybody will hate it. And so they pressured the producer, whose name, Walter Wanger. Yeah. Poor guy.
Yeah.
So they pressured him, and then he had to pressure the director, even though the both of them were like, we love this ending, though. But they finally just caved in the end and said, okay, fine, we got to get it released.
Yeah.
And so they came up with this framing story, and Wanger was trying to... He apparently had all these ideas about voiceovers and prefaces and epilogues, and he tried to get a like famous Winston Churchill quote to use at the beginning, and he couldn't get it. And then he tried to write a speech for Orson Welles and convince him. He was in Europe at the time, just sort of like, he'd not been kicked out, but left on very bad terms from America a few years before.
Okay.
So he tried to get Orson Welles to do this like introduction speech. That didn't pan out. He tried to get the author Ray Bradbury to do the speech. That didn't pan out.
They ended up having to settle with Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. It was they settled with the screenwriter. Was like, okay, screw it, I got this, and he just wrote the framing story and knocked it out.
I see.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I'm not a huge fan of the framing story, knowing that that's how it came to be. Like, I think it would have made. Been a little bit more effective, like just kind of starting on the calm and letting it. I mean, that's what kind of the appeal of this movie, and also of course of the remake and stuff, is just that sort of slow burn. Like it's never a slow film, but like it's constantly moving. It's constantly peeling back layers, and I feel like the framing story really just sort of undercuts that, because like. You get this guy rolling in here, raving mad, being like, "Oh, something so terrifying!" Like it's like, okay, well, we'll be the judge of that. And then, you know, and then we cut back, and then it starts, and like from the moment that flashback starts, that's when the movie really gets going good. Like,
right, yep.
But that also, I mean, that sort of frame story isn't. Necessarily, it was very common in old film noir movies, like Dead on Arrival and stuff like that, where the guy comes in with a gunshot wound, and he tells you at the beginning, he's like, "Well, I suppose you're wondering how a bloke like me wound up in a place like this." And it's like, "Well, let me tell you." And then I love, like you pointed out, the water dissolve into the.
Oh yeah, it's beautiful. It's practically like Wayne's World when they do the woodle woodle.
Tried and true, baby. I think the framing sort of undercut that, but hey, that's why they remade it, right?
That's showbiz, baby. On the technical side, the one big thing to point out would be that this movie, Super Scope was how they shot this. It had only been invented 2 years earlier.
Okay.
This was one of 9 films total done with this process. And the way that it worked was they took standard 35mm film.
Okay.
And removed the optical soundtrack, which meant that they could now use more of the film in order to create a bigger image.
Okay.
And then they, I got some conflicting information, but it sounded like they matted the frame from there into widescreen, but then also like stretched that in some fashion. To me, it looked really cool. Apparently the producer Wenger, actually hated it. Like he didn't realize until late in the game that they were doing the Super Scope thing. And he thought it just blew away all the detail. Everything looked too soft and muddy to him. Which I thought was curious. But he of course lost out, and now we have one of a pretty early widescreen movie. I was trying to look up the, you know, widescreen has been around technically for a super long time, but it wasn't until the 50s that it really got going.
Yeah.
And suddenly you had like 6 or 7 different processes. What are the names here? CinemaScope, Panavision, VistaVision, SuperScope, Cinerama. And they're all trying to figure out this widescreen thing. In terms of being black and white and widescreen, and shot like a film noir, do you think that those elements came together, or do you think it would have worked better as just a regular 4:3 movie?
Oh, man. I mean, I guess that's a tough question, just because we're so used to 16:9 now that seeing 4:3 always looks kind of, I think the last movie I saw that was actually 4:3. Oh, The Lighthouse. That was 4:3. Oh, yeah. But,
unusual today, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't, I guess I didn't feel like I was taken out of the movie because of it being shot in widescreen, just because, like I said, I'm probably so used to it now.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my answer is yes, John.
Maybe if I could phrase it a different way, do you think they...
Very well.
Do you think they took good advantage of it being widescreen?
Actually, yeah, kind of. There were a lot, like, it was, for as much as that camera moved and stuff, they did a really good job. I remember the one where they're in the car, they're running from they're trying to escape the cops, and they ditched the car in the
used car lot.
The used car lot. But that whole scene, like the way it whips in with the, and you have the car whipping down the alleyway with the headlights and stuff, and then it pans over, whips right in, and like I think the wide angle kind of lends itself to that, just giving depth to, especially like again when in the tunnel scene,
mm-hmm.
when you have those boards kind of coming down, just that wide angle, that sort of almost fisheye effect on the very front of those boards, like I thought it, yeah, I'd say they used it to great advantage. It made the shots a lot more dynamic.
Yeah, I noticed even on some subtler shots, it was really cool. Like I pointed out, we were watching it, that in the, when they go to the friend's house, what's his name? Jack. They go to Jack's house for the first time. They see the body. And there was this weird shot where they put the camera up like 2 or 3 feet above the actors' heads, looking down at them. And it was neat how well they used the composition of that wide frame in order to have action moving from one side of the room to the other. You can see everybody in a row while they're at the bar. The whole time you're also seeing the body in the background.
Yeah.
Clever stuff.
Really well in the movie. Mm-hmm. Like there wasn't a wasted inch. Yeah. I love, and the, especially a lot of the choreography once it, like with the extras and stuff, when it got into that, when they were hiding up in the apartment, they're looking out the window and they see the main town square and they see the trucks come in. And just the way that people like all came out and amassed in the middle of that town square and like unloaded the trucks and then all got in their cars and stuff. Like
It's creepy.
It was very creepy. It was very in unison, very well choreographed. It was great.
Mm-hmm. I did look up, so in terms of the Criterion Collection, this is actually number 8, their first widescreen movie, the first letterboxed release.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I thought maybe it was the first letterboxed film ever, but it turned out they were beat by just 2 years.
By just one other movie?
No, a handful. So in 1984, have you ever heard of a CED disc?
Uh-uh.
It's a capacitive electronic disc, something like that. So yeah. It's just before Laserdisc, there is this other competing format where it was actually a vinyl disc that had a movie on it.
Okay.
So there was just like a real record, there was a needle that went down on it and tracked the groove and plugged into a TV to show you the image.
Whoa.
Yeah. The quality apparently was just terrible, like worse than VHS. Yeah. So it didn't really last. But it had the distinction of the first widescreen home releases. In 1984, they put out a movie called Emmercord, which I can't remember the director. I believe it's an Italian film that's also in the Criterion Collection by chance.
Okay.
But at the very least, this was the Criterion's first effort at it, and something they became quite famous for, of trying very, very hard to honor the crew's original vision of this movie by not cutting out a quarter of the movie.
Oh, okay.
On all sides. So I thought that this is a pretty cool movie to start off with for widescreen.
Yeah. And also on Laserdisc. Like I said, I don't think I've actually watched a Laserdisc since like sixth grade. And that is so many lifetimes ago. I'm out there and not go into that.
Was it an educational film then?
Yeah, all of them were. I don't think I've ever actually watched like a movie on Laserdisc ever. I think that was the first.
Okay. Well, there we go.
Not to date myself, but closing in on 40, I'm glad it happened soon.
You can knock that off of your bucket list, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, with that, the last notes I had were on some of the cast and crew, just some interesting things I found.
Yeah.
So, Kevin McCarthy, who is the main character, Dr. Miles.
Yeah.
He, like apparently most of the actors in the movie, started acting in college. Like, didn't realize he wanted to do it until he got to college.
Uh-huh.
Like so many of us. And he went into World War II. He joined the Army Air Forces. And when he got back, he became a founding member of the Actors Studio.
Okay.
Which is the one inside the Actors Studio with James Lipton, that famous series.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that he was a founding part of that, which I thought was pretty cool. His first film credit, right off the bat, he got an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor because he was Biff Loman in Death of a Salesman.
Oh, well, all right.
Yeah, and that was only in 1951. So he'd only been acting for 4 years when he was in Invasion.
Wow.
Yeah. And of course, this movie ended up being his most famous role. It did say he had a cameo in the remake as a man running through the streets shouting a warning. Do you remember this part in the remake?
Oh gosh, no, I don't. It's been a couple years since I've seen the film. I want to watch it now.
Yeah, just to spot him. And then lastly, he played the villain in Weird Al Yankovic's UHF.
Okay.
Yep, he is TV station owner R.J. Fletcher.
Beautiful. That I would actually argue is probably his finest work.
He's in two famous cult classic movies. How many people did that?
Not many. All right, and then who did he play in this? Art Hindle was another guy that was in this.
Okay.
Or hold on. Yeah, was that right? and he was in The Brood. I mean, who did he play? He was in a bunch of stuff, actually. He was in The Brood, and he was also in the original Black Christmas.
Oh, I've heard of these. I haven't seen either of them.
Yeah, I was trying to find. I'm sorry. Go ahead and talk. I'm still looking stuff.
Yeah, no problem. So then we have Dana Winter, who played Becky.
Yeah,
she is also best known for this particular role in Body Snatchers. She apparently studied to become a doctor, but yet again ditched it for acting when she got to college. Went completely down a different path. And she ended up, she was British, actually, so she was doing an American accent in this movie.
Oh, very well done.
Yeah, not bad. And she didn't have anything else noticeable or notable that I found, other than there's a disaster movie called Airport from 1970.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it, but as far as I know, when that movie came out, suddenly there was this huge string of disaster movies throughout the 70s.
Yeah. Airplane, I think, was a spoof of it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we got King Donovan, who played Jack. He was mostly a TV actor, but the funny tidbit I found was that in 1963, he directed a movie called Promises, Promises.
Yeah.
And it was, quote, the first Hollywood sound film to feature a mainstream film star, Jane Mansfield, nude. That's his claim to fame.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, good job.
Good
King
for
Dad.
Him. lastly, Carolyn Jones, who played Theodora, Jack's wife, who went by Teddy. She was actually nominated for Best Supporting Actress just a couple years later for The Bachelor Party, and later became Morticia Adams in the original Adams Family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I thought that was neat.
Far out.
Then on the crew side, we've got the director Don Siegel. He was born here in Chicago, and he ended up doing almost his entire career was gritty crime movies. So he started out, he was actually a montage director, and he directed the opening montage for Casablanca, where they have the globe spinning and you see the map with like the line that travels across the map to show where things are going.
Yeah, yeah.
That was like apparently his idea, or at least he made it happen.
Far out.
Yeah. Then he ended up going to work on several of Clint Eastwood's movies, including Dirty Harry.
You bet.
Then he did John Wayne's last film, The Shootist, and Ronald Reagan's last film, The Killers. Then you got producer Walter Wanger. He went into theater in college, of course, and then served in World War I. And when he got back, he started working in film in the 20s. He was actually president of the Academy for several years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. At Paramount, he was the one who found the novel The Sheik that turned into Valentino's very famous movie.
Oh, okay.
Which kind of cemented his career, Wanger's career. He eventually did. He brought in the Marx Brothers for their first movie, The Coconuts. He did Stagecoach, 1939.
Yep.
And then eventually nominated for Best Picture for Cleopatra.
Yep.
And the best part of his story, I think, is in 1951, he was married to an actress named Joan Bennett. Joan Bennett, just as an aside, she apparently played Elizabeth Stoddard in the show Dark Shadows. The mom, and Madame Blanc in Suspiria.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Yep. So
far out.
Wanger suspected his wife, Joan Bennett, of sleeping with her agent. So one day he packed a gun, went and found them in a parking lot, hanging out at a car, came up, shot twice, hit the guy in his leg and his groin, which is the place you want to shoot if you're mad at him for an affair.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
And then got arrested. And he went to jail for 4 months for shooting this guy. Thankfully, the guy survived.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but this experience of spending 4 months in jail apparently inspired a movie that he and Don Siegel both worked on just before Invasion called Riot in Cell Block 11. Which, judging by the plot of that movie, he must have had a terrible time in prison.
Oh my gosh. Yep.
And then lastly, as we talked about briefly during the movie, Sam Peckinpah, he's a director who's famous for The Wild Bunch and Straw Dogs. He was also worked on Riot in Cell Block 11. That was his first movie that he worked on. And he became a dialogue coach on Invasion. And then had a little part as the gas station attendant.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember you pointing him out.
Mm-hmm.
Far out.
Yeah. Finally, as far as influence goes, clearly this is a cult classic. It was ignored by a lot of critics initially, but it now has 98% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. We've had three remakes so far. We've got Invasion of the Body Snatchers 1978, which we talked about with Donald Sutherland.
Yeah.
Just Body Snatchers in 1993. I didn't recognize anybody famous in that one.
Okay.
And then the movie The Invasion from 2007, starring Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Which neither of us have seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there is, in fact, a fourth one on the way from Warner Brothers as of 2017. Yep, it's coming. And it is from the screenwriter of The Conjuring 2.
Oh.
Does that mean anything to you?
It's one of the guys that did the Insidious movies, if I'm not mistaken. Not James Wan, the other one. I think that's who wrote that. Hold on. Now you gotta
look it up. Yeah,
I gotta look it up. Conjuring. Oh, Chad Hayes, maybe Cary Hayes. That's not who I thought it was. Okay, yeah, I don't know who it is.
All right, so chances are iffy. On whether this movie will be any good.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah. This Invasion that we watched was selected in 1994 for preservation by the U.S. National Film Registry. One of the pretty early ones for that to happen. I think they didn't start doing that until 1991.
Oh, really?
Because High Noon was, I can't remember if it was the first one or one of the first ones. They take a copy of the movie, like they make a copy of the negative, and they keep it at the Library of Congress in their archives.
Yeah, yeah.
Just so that the country has a copy in case something happens to Warner Brothers or Paramount or whatever.
Well, you know, and this is one of those movies I think we really need to hold on to.
Yeah, America's... you know, it's a part of our culture.
It's America's movie, damn it.
All right. Well, with that, my last question always is about whether you think that this movie in particular belongs in something like the Criterion Collection. And I'll let you know their premise for any movie that goes into the collection is any important historical or contemporary film. That's literally all they put on it.
Yeah.
So, knowing what you know, do you think this is important enough to save in something like this?
I'd say so, yeah. I mean, I think it checks a lot of boxes if you were trying to get an idea of what... I mean, this movie is sort of like a cookie-cutter version of a lot of movies of this era. I mean, it's got the McCarthy scare. It's got the anti-communism scare. It's got film noir elements and sci-fi elements, and it clips along at a good pace. Like, I'd say, yeah, for its time,
that's a pretty good movie that still holds up well, I think, honestly.
Yeah.
Like,
I have to agree.
It wasn't anything that I thought really, I mean, the style and stuff that dates the movie, of course, and like, but I mean, there were still just like, there is a sort of an unnerving, creepy quality about the movie that as it goes along, it gets its hooks into you, mm-hmm. you know?
That's funny that you said that, because the thing that flashed through my mind just before you said that was him with a pitchfork, and it actually shows the pitchfork going into that guy's chest.
That was a pretty ballsy shot for
it was
50, for 56.
Yeah, you know? Unusually violent.
Yeah,
yeah. Would you ever watch this again?
Yeah, I'd watch this again. Like I really want to watch the Donald Sutherland one now. But yeah, this was a pleasant surprise. Like I've seen my other, like, of the remakes of this time, the only other ones that really jumped out were like John Carpenter's The Thing. And I saw the original The Thing from Another World here, I'd say in the last couple of years. And I didn't like that one. There were a lot of doors in that movie, but I didn't really get the creeping paranoia. I didn't think it was quite as effective as it was in something like this. This one really, I thought, kind of drove that home a lot better. Carpenter would eventually get that right with his remake, but like,
oh boy, yeah. Did he?
Yeah. But yeah, I'd say this film warrants being in a collection that remembers film. Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay.
Well, I approve that message.
Thank you so much, Sean, for being a part of this. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Glad you had fun.
I had a great time. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. And let's see. Next movie is going to be number 9, The Magnificent Ambersons. I will see you all then.